Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Zatarain's, a New Orleans tradition since 1889. From our studios in the Southern Food and Beverage Museum in New Orleans, this is Louisiana Eats. I'm Poppy Tooker. Springtime in Louisiana is simply one of the most delicious seasons ever. On this week's Louisiana Eats, we welcome in the season with a visit to the Elmer Chocolate Factory in Ponchatoula, Louisiana, where every year they roll back time in order to produce the Heavenly Hash, Gold Brick, and pecan eggs so prized by residents of the Gulf South. You'll be amazed to hear how the highly automated plant returns to a hands-on manufacturing process in order to satiate Louisiana's love for Elmer's Easter candy. Another sure harbinger of spring is Derby season. So legendary bartender and raconteur Chris McMillan joins us with a tribute to the Derby's most famous drink, the mint julep. And no matter where in the world you live, spring is the season for lovers. We'll take a trip to North Louisiana and visit St. Terre in Benton, which hosts some of Louisiana's most romantic weddings in a charming countryside setting, where every wish of the bride and groom is fulfilled, even when there's fire involved. So turn down those cheeping chicks and turn up the radio. It's springtime on Louisiana Eats. If your childhood was spent anywhere from Beaumont, Texas to Mobile, Alabama, it's a good guess your Easter basket was filled with Elmer Gold Bricks, Heavenly Hash, and pecan eggs. With a heritage that reaches back to 1855, Elmer Chocolate is not only the oldest candy maker in Louisiana, but one of the oldest in the nation. Today's president and CEO, Rob Nelson, is the third generation of only the second family to guide the Elmer Chocolate Company. He invited our Louisiana Eats crew to take a tour of his state-of-the-art chocolate factory in Ponchatoula. Upon arriving, I asked Rob how it was that Elmer earned its delicious reputation.
Well, I think in any business, you have to be the best at whatever you do if you're going to be around for the long haul. So for the things that we've chosen to concentrate as being our business, we have, I think, the most efficient plant in the world for what we do. Now, people locally know us for Easter candy. They don't even know that we're in box chocolates, a lot of people. But Easter candy is a very, very small part of our business. We only run it for about 6 weeks. We're making it the same way it's been made for decades. And really for the reason that here in Louisiana, people expect what they expect, and we can't change it. So we do it the same way.
Let's go back to the beginning. What prompted your grandfather to get into the candy business?
He was single at the time, and met a woman from New Orleans, and on his first date said he would marry her. Now, they weren't New Orleans time, so he came down to visit New Orleans for the first time. He flew from Los Angeles to New Orleans, and she was supposed to pick him up at the airport. And it's a funny story because he waited and waited, and she never showed up. So this is right around 1959, 1960, somewhere in there. He's looking at his watch. He said, well, if she's not here in 10 minutes, I'm going to grab that flight back to Los Angeles. So lo and behold, she showed up right at the last minute, and so he stayed, and they ended up getting married, and he stayed in New Orleans. So I like to joke around with people here in the company that's how close it came to us not being where we are today.
Your Easter candy business in the Gulf South is truly standalone. Tell us a little bit about that. What happens to the Easter candy from the rest of the country? We just don't let it across the state line.
Well, it's out there, but it's really amazing. And every year, there's a national leader throughout the country, the number one item in the United States. But in this market, from Beaumont, Texas to Mobile, Alabama, about as far north as I-20, there are three items that outsell that item in this market. And that's Gold Brick, Heavenly Hash, and pecan eggs. Why is that? I think, it's a tradition. There are people that they buy it at this time of year and they store it in their freezer to have it all year long. I have a lot of evidence to that, and I hear a lot of stories to that effect. One, after the Saints won the Super Bowl, we did a Saints version of the Gold Brick and Heavenly Hash, and it sold really well. But I could tell that people even hoarded that because it affected next year's Easter sales. So you know that there's something going on there. The other thing, and they say that there's no such thing as bad publicity, but front page, New York Times, not long after Katrina, you know, the days of everybody pulling their refrigerator out to the street, and then the street was lined with refrigerators. Well, they had a photograph of a freezer, and it was filled with our product. Didn't look so good in September of 2005, but there it was, front page of the New York Times.
Elaborate for me a bit about how you managed to go from this very high-tech production to hands-on, hand-dipping, hand-wrapping, low-tech Easter production.
You know, it's a challenge. You know, it's a whole different skill set. It's a whole different set of equipment, and it's almost like each year we have to remember how to do it. We all like to sometimes get our hands in the dough in the kitchen, right? And certainly it's fun to do something that's appreciated. You know, for people that work here, sometimes they're thought of as being celebrities in their neighborhood because that's what they do, you know? So it's fun. It's amazing how much attention we get this time of year for something we only do 6 weeks a year.
So you grew up in this business. What are your earliest memories? I know you said you went to work with your dad as a child a lot, but tell me about growing up in a chocolate business. What was that like?
So Easter was really the bread and butter of the company at that point in time, and the selling process was different. I mean, we had people going to the stores in New Orleans, and you know, we had K&B and we had Schwegmans and we had all these other retailers that just bought so much. I mean, you would go to a K&B drugstore and one side of the aisle was us and the other side of the aisle was everybody else. So it was major. And every Good Friday growing up, I was here in this building helping to load trucks. We would load trucks on Good Friday. We would load trucks the day before Easter. So, you know, my friends were going to Florida for Easter or whatever, and I was driving a truck. And I do remember as a kid, you know, waiting for those last orders on the day before Easter, and in between trucks, we would skateboard through the factory. Because, I mean, there are these perfectly smooth floors, and, I mean, it's a lot easier to skateboard in the Elmer Candy Factory rather than on the streets of New Orleans. So it really worked out well, and a lot of times I was able to bring friends to come do that. You know, it was work, but it was fun. Today, everything's sold on data. It goes in. We sell it, you know, by Valentine's Day for Easter, and we don't make any more.
Tell us those wild numbers. How many pieces of candy? How many boxes?
We're making about 3,000 pieces a minute. So we're making 4.5-5 million pieces of candy a day. We've devised a way to capture that and move it around efficiently. And none of our chocolates for boxed chocolate are ever touched by human hands. So it's made on state-of-the-art equipment. As it's moved around, it's encased, kind of a configuration we've designed, and then it's packed by robotic arm, picks it up, puts it in the box at very high speeds. So we have multiple lines, but if all of our lines were making that same product, we could make 800 boxes of candy every minute. What we make, I would say 70% of what we make all year long sells in about 3 days.
Once I heard those numbers, I had to see for myself what happens in a state-of-the-art chocolate factory when time is rolled back over 50 years.
Just real quick, we just need to wash our hands and get some alcohol gel.
Luckily, the Elmer employees were more serious about their jobs than Lucy and Ethel were on that I Love Lucy episode from the 1950s. As the exposed, shiny marshmallow insides of Heavenly Hash passed on a constantly moving belt, several ladies stood by, each poking two whole almonds into every egg.
There's not very many marshmallows out there on the market you can do this to.
A little further along, a group stood around a vat of chopped pecans, coating the nougat eggs with nuts as they were hand-tossed about. Much of the wrapping and packing was done completely by hand as well. A far cry from the mechanized precision that drives their production the rest of the year.
Hey, Miss Sarah, how are you?
As we walked through the factory, Rob showed us Elmer's complex robotics in action.
So this building, the office building and the building we're walking into here was built in the late 60s. It had opened up in January of 1970. And it's been added on to multiple times, the most recent in 2016. The technology is called cold stamp. We went from enrobing our chocolates, which was making a center, putting on the belt, and then dosing, you know, just completely covering with chocolate, to making a molded product. And to get that center on the inside of the piece, we have to make a shell for the chocolate, then we put the center in, and then we put a bottom on it. But it's a long process. It's about, this whole line, as a mold travels through the line, it's 130 yards, so it's longer than a football field. And there's many different stages to it, and it goes vertically and back, so it's really more than 130 yards. The cold stamp room over here, this is the driest place in the state of Louisiana. It's 1% humidity. When this line was installed, it was the best line in the United States.
Does your sugar come from all over the world, I imagine?
No, it comes from Louisiana. About 70% of all cacao beans are coming from Western Africa. So I would say all the beans that we're using are coming from Ghana. And cacao trees grow within 20 degrees of the Earth equator, so you're limited where it can grow. And Africa is the biggest producer, and those beans will come to the United States, and then we bring it in by tank truck.
So a big tanker truck full of chocolate arrives here.
Yeah, so you see big stainless steel trucks on the highway.
Yes.
You know, you think maybe that's oil, maybe that's gasoline. It could be chocolate. And I had a story one time, and this is a long time ago, this is probably back in the 70s, but we had a truck that was delivering chocolate. And he took a wrong turn, and he went down the wrong street here in Ponchatoula. Anyway, he was going over a railroad crossing, I think he jackknifed a truck, and so the chocolate started coming out the top of the truck. And all the kids in the neighborhood ran over and were like showering in the chocolate. They thought it was the most amazing thing ever.
Oh, that's crazy.
No, we didn't use that chocolate after.
Rob Nelson, President and CEO of the Elmer Chocolate Company. After a short break, we visit a much smaller chocolate-making operation, the first in Louisiana to go direct from bean to bar. Carol Morse of Akali Chocolate is coming up after the break. Don't go anywhere. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Rouse's Markets, from Camellia Brand, Beans Done Right, a New Orleans tradition since 1923, and also from the Napoleon House, historic charm in the heart of the French Quarter, home of the Pimm's Cup cocktail and the toasted muffalata. Lunch, dinner, and private events at 500 Charter Street. Are you podcasting Louisiana Eats yet? If not, it's time to subscribe. We've launched a new podcast series, Louisiana Eats Quick Bites. Quick Bites combine previously unaired interviews with lots of info and recipes, too. Our most recent podcast gives you a complete tutorial on how to boil crawfish like the pros do, featuring Dr. Boyle himself, also known as Claude Davis of Zatarain's. He shares some tips and tricks that even this crawfish boiling fool had never seen before. You don't want to miss this. So subscribe today on our podcast page at poppytooker.com. That way, you won't miss a single serving of our broadcast or our new Quick Bites podcast. And now, back to Louisiana Eats. Not many of us can say we won an award on our first day in business. Carol Morris is the owner of Akali Chocolate, the first of a small circle of bean-to-bar chocolate makers in New Orleans. Carol launched her chocolate bars at the 2015 Good Food Awards in San Francisco, taking home a prize before her chocolate was available anywhere for sale. Akali sources cacao that once, in bar form, brings out a diverse array of flavors worthy of a wine tasting. Producer Sarah Holtz joined Carol at her West Bank production facility to learn about her bean-to-bar process. Carol began with how she got started working with chocolate.
My husband's an archaeologist, so he does a lot of field work in Guatemala, and I went down to visit him, and we visited some cacao growers. I talked with people that were working with chocolate in Antigua, Guatemala, and I had always loved chocolate. I thought I was going to be an archaeologist when I was in college. That's what I was studying as well. And then I got really interested in sort of microfinance and economic development after that. And then when I started thinking more about chocolate making, it seemed like it combined a lot of things that I'm excited about and passionate about. It had sort of the anthropological aspect with getting to go down to visit origin and meet growers. And I don't know, it just seemed like a lot of things came together. I started making it at home after we got back, and then the business kind of followed. The cocoa beans that I buy come from two parts of Peru. So there's the one bar, the El Platanal bar, that's named for this community of about 54 cacao growers in the Chulucanas region of Peru. And then the beans in the Norandino bar come from six different communities in the Tumbes region of Peru. The cooperative itself is pretty large. They started out as a coffee cooperative, so they've got coffee growers, cacao growers, fruit growers. Each one of the cacao growers has a plot that can be very small. And so what they do, since each individual cacao grower might not be growing that much cacao, when they harvest, they bring all of that cacao to a central, what they call a beneficio, kind of a central small facility where they ferment it and dry it and prepare it for export. I might, if you don't mind, we might both wash our hands. I'm taking you right now into my bean storage closet. So you can see I have these dunnage racks with all the bags of cocoa beans on them. These over here are the El Platanal beans, and then these over here are the beans that go into the Norandino and the Milk and Nibs bar. Because I have them in these airtight bags, you can't really smell the scent of them right now, but I actually am gonna open this one up if y'all are curious, because they've got just such an interesting fragrant, almost like a balsamic vinegar smell. And so you can really see here the difference between the two beans that I use. The El Platanal beans tend to be smaller and more red in color, and the Norandino beans from the Tumbes region tend to be a little bit bigger and more brownish. I don't know, it's interesting, they smell different. You kind of get the chance to really see how the bars themselves could end up tasting so different. And that's kind of what's neat about those, the two dark bars that I make as well. They're both 70% cocoa, which means that by weight, 70% of the product is cocoa beans and 30% is sugar. And since there's no other ingredients, you can really compare the flavors of the cocoa beans themselves and what's actually due to the difference in those beans. That's what I think is so exciting about chocolate making and having so many chocolate makers that have started just even in the past 5 years, 7 years, that are really trying to focus on highlighting the beans themselves, where they came from, the flavors within those beans. The idea of terroir, you hear the comparison to wine a lot. It's like wine grapes or coffee, where you just have such a wide array of flavor possibilities. And I think people are used to thinking of chocolate sometimes as Halloween candy, as just kind of this sweet treat. And it can be that, and that can be great, but it's also exciting to really taste the potential that's in cacao itself. I'll shut this and we can actually move through. This door is going to be roasting. So roasting is a very key stage. As I mentioned earlier, fermentation and drying is when you kind of develop what they call flavor precursors. What happens during roasting is that you actually convert those precursors into the chemicals that we recognize as flavors and the flavors that we associate with chocolate. So roasting does a number of things. It develops flavors. It helps the beans detach from the husk that's wrapped around the outside of them. So that makes the husk easier to remove after you've roasted. And it's also kind of the pasteurization stage for the cocoa beans. So roasting is a very important part of the process. One thing people talk about a lot is smell. You start to get this really nice baking brownie smell a lot of times from cocoa bean roasting, which is very pleasant. You look for that. So then I take the beans out of the roasting room and over here to my winnower, which is a very eccentric looking piece of equipment. There's a lot of PVC pipe involved. So kind of the next stage, the nib, those broken up pieces of cocoa bean, are what go into my melangers. And you load the nibs into this machine and just the pressure from the stones liquefies them, because cocoa beans just naturally have about 50 to 55% cocoa butter content. So under the pressure and the heat of the wheels, they liquefy over time. And so in the melanger, the first thing that starts happening is the nib gets shattered and broken into smaller and smaller pieces, smaller and smaller particles, eventually becoming so small that you can't feel them with your tongue. And this is also where I add sugar, and if I'm making milk chocolate, I add milk powder at this stage as well. And the machine also, it gets hot, and some of kind of the volatiles or undesirable flavors get burned off. And then you've also got the cocoa butter really coating all the solid particles and creating this just smooth, creamy chocolate. So this machine runs for about 3 days, and then when I remove the chocolate from it, it's ready to be tempered. The chocolate's quite hot coming out of the melanger. It's usually about 140 degrees. And so the tempering machine then is gonna drop the temperature of it and allow all these crystals of cocoa butter to form. And then I mold that liquid chocolate into bars and shake the air bubbles out of the chocolate before I set it on those shelves over there to firm up, which takes about half an hour.
Carol Morse of Akali Chocolate. Our friends at Camellia Brand consistently post incredible recipe ideas on their website. This spring, their innovative work with white beans has really caught my attention. So, for the first time ever, white beans will play an integral role on my Easter dinner table. Their warm asparagus, mushroom, and white bean salad is going to be the perfect accompaniment for my Easter ham, providing a great vegan-vegetarian alternative for those who are so inclined. Fresh asparagus cut into 2-inch pieces are microwaved briefly, then sautéed in olive oil with shiitake mushrooms and garlic. The sautéed ingredients get tossed together with cooked Camellia Brand Great Northern beans, avocado, arugula, lemon juice, and lemon peel for the brightest tasting, freshest bean salad to hit your dining room table yet. For the full recipe, visit our website at poppytooker.com. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats. New Orleans bartender Chris McMillan is legendary in the mixology community for his understanding and love for classic cocktails. Order any drink from him at his bar and restaurant, Revel, and you'll quickly see why. But if there's one cocktail that Chris is most closely associated with, it's the mint julep. We spoke with Chris to learn all about this quintessential springtime concoction. Chris, would you walk us through the classic preparation of the
Absolutely. You need just a couple of essential items, preferably a metal cup, silver if possible. Mm-hmm. And if you don't have that, a Collins-style glass that's thin so it'll more efficiently radiate away the heat from the glass. You need some beautiful fresh mint, crushed ice, and a good bourbon. I take my metal glass, put a small quantity of simple syrup in the bottom of the glass, which is a equal mixture of water and granulated sugar mixed and shaken together until dissolved. You don't have to heat it. It'll dissolve in a matter of seconds. That's why they call it simple. We put just a little bit in the bottom of the glass and then take a large handful of mint and squeeze it in your hand so that you just release those oils, and then drop it into the bottom of the glass. Take a muddler and just gently rub the mint against the sides of the glass, touching all of the surfaces. And the small amount of simple syrup we placed in there acts as an adhesive. So it holds the mint all over the interior of the glass, distributing the oil evenly. And then you fill it up with as much crushed ice as you can get into it, and even a couple of inches above the glass, making a tall cone like a snow cone. Because when you hit it with that room temperature alcohol, the volume of the ice is going to subside dramatically and rapidly. So if you want it to be filled, you need to overfill it with ice. And then you just pour the simple syrup after having gotten the bourbon in there. Pour the simple syrup over it, and sweetness is a matter of preference. The beauty of the drink is its simplicity, and it's about the bourbon, the mint, the sugar, and the ice, and nothing else.
What makes a drink a julep?
Julep was a Persian word, and it meant rose water. If we ever go to places like Limona's or Lebanon's Cafe, and we have their Lebanese iced tea, which is a rose water flavored tea, it's kind of the concept. It very early on comes to mean a flavored syrup, and those syrups were used in connection with medicinal compounds. And inherent in the word julep is a tonic effect. And you had different kinds of juleps dependent upon what tonic effect you were seeking. A spoonful of sugar helps the medicine go down, if you will. And by the beginning of the 19th century, julep takes on a dual role. You know, one as this medicinal tonic, and the other as a recreational beverage. And it maintains this dual meaning. It was the first drink to popularize the use of ice. Historically, what the martini was to the 20th century, the julep was to the 19th century as the quintessential American beverage.
That is so interesting. And I noticed that you don't stir a julep.
The julep, there are very few drinks that have the quality of being multidimensional, that when you start it, it tastes one way. When you finish it, it tastes a different way. Because of the different densities of the ingredients, you have water from the ice, you have alcohol from the bourbon, you have sugar from the syrup. Each one of those things has a different weight. And so as the drink settles and as the drink dilutes, those flavors have different intensities at different levels. And so the deeper you get into it, the mintier it's going to become, the sweeter it's going to become. I tell people when having their julep for the first time, when you first drink it, you're going to say, oh my God, can I drink this? It's going to be the biggest, stiffest shot of bourbon you ever had. But if you get to about right here, and that's about 2/3 of the way down the drink. It starts to have diluted and softened up a little bit, becomes a little mintier, a little bit sweeter. And by the time you get to the end of it, you're going to wish it'll never end. It's really a lovely thing.
Well, it sounds to me like all of those people who you see stirring madly in their silver cups, trying to get that icy outside, are really doing the drink inside an injustice.
If you want to make the exterior of the cup frost, it needs to be dry.
Ah.
If it's wet, it won't frost. But if it's dry, it will. And so that's really, it's a matter of technique and understanding of the process.
Would you elaborate for me on the different treatments of the mint and what you're doing and why?
Mint is a delicate herb. And your object is not to crush the herb, but to release the oil, the perfume of the mint itself. And that doesn't require extensive manipulation. I use probably 5 times the mint that most people use. And by using more mint, it requires less manipulation to produce more oil. If you over-extract the mint, all plants, the green is chlorophyll, which is bitter. And if you over-extract the mint, you will add bitter flavors to the drink. You can hide it in a mint julep under the robust, intense flavors of bourbon. But a mojito, on the contrast, same principle, is often ruined by bartenders who think they're demonstrating their skill to you by showing you their muddling technique. And by over-extracting the mint, they're releasing those bitter flavors, and it destroys the drink. And, you know, I mean, its essence is rum, sugar, mint, club soda. Almost the same. In fact, you could even say that a mojito is probably influenced by the mint julep, you know, and an evolution of the Cuban expression of the mint julep within the context of their culture and their indigenous ingredients.
Why is the mint julep so closely tied to horse racing?
Well, it originally came from Virginia. All of what we now call Kentucky was once part of Bourbon County, Virginia. Kentuckians don't widely like to acknowledge this.
Okay.
But the thing that makes Kentucky a great place for horses, the thing that makes Kentucky a great place for the production of whiskey, is its natural geology. It's limestone, which is a natural occurring material. It's calcium that's decayed through the eons, and the water, the rain, filters through that calcium substrata. Well, I'm not a geologist, so I don't have the correct terms there, but it softens the water and makes it calcium rich. Calcium makes big, strong bones, which make for great horse races, that makes the bluegrass blue. And wherever you make whiskey, you must have large amounts of water and the right kind of it. So that's the reason why Scotland is also one of the great whiskey producing regions of the world, is because of its water.
Well, Chris, I want to thank you so much for treating all of the Louisiana Eats audience to the classic mint julep.
Well, that's very sweet of you. It was my pleasure.
Chris McMillan, Master Mixologist. You can find the legendary New Orleans barman mixing drinks and sharing his knowledge at Revel in New Orleans Mid-City.
One early morning, as I was walking, I met a woman, started talking. I took her home to get a few nips, but all I had was
now that Chris McMillan has you all ready to make that mint julep, where's the mint going to come from? Stay tuned, and we'll help answer that question when we come right back.
Thinking double, I'm through with flirting and drinking whiskey.
I got 6 extra children from a getting frisky.
Oh, a mint julep, a mint julep, a mint julep.
I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen, Zatarain's, and from French Market Coffee. French Market Coffee's premium blended beans are locally roasted in small batches, creating a coffee that can only be called New Orleans Bold. Here's this week's culinary quiz question, brought to you with support from Popeye's Louisiana Culinary Institute. Now that we've learned all about making mint juleps from master cocktailian Chris McMillan, just where is all that mint going to come from? If you're a resident of the South, it should come right from your own backyard. Mint is a perennial, which means once you plant it, it will come back time and time again. In fact, unless there's a hard freeze, your backyard mint is likely to stay productive year-round. First, find the best place for planting. Mint prefers partial shade and loves moist ground. Goodness knows, we've got a lot of that in Louisiana. You'll only need a couple of starters planted about 2 feet apart to quickly grow a full bed of mint. Mint can be invasive, setting out to conquer new territory with horizontal runners and underground rhizomes. In just a year, one little plant can turn into a sprawling 4-foot giant. The good news is, mint loves to be trimmed, and the best way to propagate more mint is simply to put the cuttings in water. In no time at all, roots will sprout, making more baby mint plants that you can share with all the neighbors. Mint makes for good neighbors, especially when the neighborhood gathers for one of your about-to-be-legendary mint juleps. I'm Poppy Tooker. And you're listening to Louisiana Eats.
Flowers come in the spring. Oh, all the love I can bring. Bring it for my baby.
I'm Holly Schreiber, and I'm the owner of St. Terre. I do all of the cooking here and also a lot of the event planning.
I am Derek Schreiber. I am the co-owner of St. Terre, married to Holly, and I do the event planning, a lot of the ceremony, music, and all the bar.
Holly and Derek Schreiber's story starts with a chance meeting in New York City and ends with weddings, lots of weddings in the small town of Benton, Louisiana. Situated in the far northwest corner of the state, Holly and Derek's wedding venue, St. Terre, combines their culinary prowess and New York style with the devotion of a truly family-run business. We paid a visit to St. Terre and learned all about Holly and Derek's journey from New York to Benton, as well as the nuptial adventures they've had along the way.
Well, we are sitting at St. Terre. It's a mainly right now weddings and events venue. We tried to say we're a turnkey wedding service because if you want to just show up the day of your wedding and have everything perfect and ready to go exactly how you want it, we do that. And this all came about when my sister actually got engaged and we couldn't find a place that she wanted that was perfect for her locally. And that's when the light bulb went off that this is what we needed to do. We had all this property that all of our family lives on, including Derek and myself, and both sets of my grandparents, my mom and dad, and aunts and uncles. And everybody, once we thought about it, had attributes that kind of were unique to pulling off an event. And so that's how the ball got rolling.
Now, Holly, you're from here, right?
Yes. I grew up here. I grew up in Benton and pretty much thought I was going to be here my whole life. And then that changed pretty drastically when I moved to New York. So.
And what caused you to move to New York?
Well, I had a winding road to going to New York. I originally was in school for nutrition and dietetics and fell in love with cooking at that point, not so much the dietetic side. And so I decided that I really needed to learn more about the chef side of things. And so that's when I decided to move to New York and go to culinary school. And that's how I ended up at the French Culinary Institute.
The French Culinary Institute. What a wonderful place that is.
Oh, it's amazing. I had such a wonderful time there and was very lucky to not only go to school there, but to be able to work there after I graduated. So it was a great experience.
And Derek, when do you come into this picture? Because you're obviously not from here.
Well, I thought that Holly was going to say, well, it was such a great thing going to the French Culinary Institute because I met Derek. But I didn't quite make that list. That's okay, though. Maybe I was third on the list. That's all right. Well, Holly and I met when I first interviewed for the position at the French Culinary Institute. I went for an interview with the president, and Holly happened to be working in events in the office, and she was the one that opened the door when I first buzzed in to the office. I didn't see a ring on her finger, so I thought, well, maybe there's something there. I was hoping she didn't work in the accounting department, and she didn't, so that was a good thing. And then so we had met there, and one thing... Yeah, the rest was history. And then a couple of years later, I was living in the country. So I went from city to country.
Derek, how much of a culture shock was it for you, Manhattan to Benton?
Well, I did know what I was getting into. So, and it's a very unique family down here. But it is. It's funny, in New York, sometimes, even though it's a big city and millions of people, you can feel isolated in New York. I had lived next to the same person for 6 years in my apartment, and I might have seen him twice. So in a way, there's a similarity in moving from the big city to the country where, you don't see as many people, but here you have a much closer bond because it's all family. We're all very close. And obviously we're all kind of doing this business together now, but it seems like a big jump, but really it's not that much of a transition.
And was Benton ready for Manhattan to come home to Benton?
We didn't know. We went through, before we arrived at what we're doing now, we went through several business plans of ideas of things that we wanted to do, mainly out of things that we missed from Manhattan that we wished were here. Right. Everything from cheese making. We originally thought we were going to do a water buffalo farm here because we have the land. And we're like, we need some fresh water buffalo mozzarella because no farms are working in the U.S. to produce this. And
we really went really far down the road. We planned this for a good year and a half. Yes. We spent on all the research, working with water buffaloes up in Texarkana, trained with them weekly. We went up. And
we went through one really bad summer.
Yeah.
Water buffalo almost need water.
The drought, yeah, right.
Very, very dry.
So we backed away from that.
Yes.
Holly, maybe you could walk us through what a bride's experience would be here from the moment they call up and want to come see the venue.
Well, we go through all of the spaces. So we walk through the venue. We walk through, we have a chapel as well. We offer an outdoor space or an indoor space and just try to make them comfortable with us, because really the main thing in planning is for them to be comfortable in us being able to handle this sort of event.
My personal motto in life, the thing that has always gotten me by, no matter what, is my motto, it'll all be fine when it's over. So share with us some of your, oh, thank God it's over.
A funny thing with all of this was our very first wedding. We were obviously not in the business of saying no to anything yet. We would do everything, anything that they wanted to do. And so it came about that the send-off, because, you have a big send-off when everybody leaves, whether it's sparklers or confetti. And this one was Chinese wishing lanterns. And you light them on fire. They float up into the air, and they're supposed to only stay lit for about 30 seconds or so, and then they burn out. But it makes for a great picture because they're all floating in the sky and all beautiful. Well, our first wedding, we had been through a severe
Drought? Oh no, it's just, yes. This is just after the water buffalo.
Yes, this was around that time. And we had also just been through the clearing process of our property, so we still had a few dead trees that we had not been able to take down with lots of dead leaves in them. So we stage everything, all these lanterns get lit and they go all and get caught in this one tree just right outside the barn. And a fire starts, and we're not even on city water. We have to have a fire truck with water attached to it come out because we're just on, you know, our well water and our whatever we have that's not city. And so all of a sudden this fire starts and these leaves, and my sister, who is coordinating all of this with a big smile on her face, comes in to the kitchen and says, I think we need to call the fire department right now. And so I start freaking out. My cousin, who is kind of our grounds guy, really is freaking out, but we're all trying to not look like we're freaking out. And so we're kind of scrambling, and the bride is like, oh, do you think there's a problem? Do we need to do something? And luckily, right at that moment when we were going to call, it started raining.
Oh, and a blessing.
I know. We were just so, so happy that that happened. But now in our contract, we don't have wishing lanterns. Right.
And yeah. What is the most outrageous request that you've ever received from a bride?
To me, the most outrageous request has been when dogs are involved. Or other animals. Brides want their dogs in the pictures. They want them in the ceremony. So there have been a number of brides. I'm thinking of one in particular that wanted her horse to be out and wanted her dogs to be out. So although this is country land and it seems all, there's a horse farm next to us and it seems conducive to all those things.
There's a lot of stuff that can go wrong with a horse going down the
right,
aisle.
Exactly.
So between, exactly. What comes out of both ends and, you know, that's not so pretty with the rose petals.
Right.
So we had to say no to the horse. We did have two large Dobermans that walked down the aisle who were also on the wedding cake, the little replicas of them. And they did fine, though. They were excellent dogs. And so they left a good impression with us for the future should we ever have to have more Dobermans at a wedding.
Well, that's really good that all the Dobermans left behind was a good impression.
Right,
that's
it.
Really
yeah.
Good. Well, thank you, Derek. Thank you, Holly.
Thank you. It's our
so
pleasure.
I hope to come to a wedding here sometime. Thank you.
You'll always be welcome, even if you're not a guest.
We'll sneak in.
Okay. I'll hang in the kitchen with
yeah.
you.
Yeah.
Holly and Derek Schreiber of St. Terre in Benton, Louisiana. That's it for this week's edition of Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Have you missed an episode of Louisiana Eats? Hear today's show or catch up on previous editions anytime online at itsneworleans.com. If you're not podcasting yet, it's time to subscribe. We've launched a new exclusive podcast series, Louisiana Eats Quick Bites. The podcasts include sneak previews of material that hasn't hit the airwaves yet, as well as exclusive full-length interviews never heard on the show before, well-seasoned with lots of food history and recipes, too. Visit our podcast page at poppytooker.com so you won't miss a single serving of our broadcast or our new podcast. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen, Zatarain's, French Market Coffee, Camellia Beans, and Rouse's Markets. Additional support for Louisiana Eats is provided by the Shreveport-Bossier Convention and Tourist Bureau, and from Dickie Brennan's Bourbon House, from oysters to redfish, serving fresh Gulf seafood on Bourbon Street, also home to the city's largest American whiskey and bourbon collection. Original theme music by Johnny Sketch and the Dirty Notes. Big thanks to producers Joe Schreiner, Sarah Holtz, and Reggie Morris. And to our business manager and social media maven, Maddie Mulladew. Come visit us anytime in our Louisiana Eats studios at the Southern Food and Beverage Museum. Don't forget to find our recipes and see what we're up to at poppytooker.com. You can also check us out on Instagram and Facebook, too. Louisiana Eats is a production of Poppy Tooker Broadcasting.